This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We will be transitioning away from coal over the course of this century. So why not plan for that now, and rather than investing, doubling down on our investments in a non-renewable and depleting resource like coal, why not just take that money and invest it on our real energy future?
Last year, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and energy consultant Daniel Yergin published his long-awaited sequel to the prize called The Quest: Energy, Security, and the Remaking of the Modern World. The New York Times called this follow-up, quote, even better than the first. It is searching, impartial, and alarmingly up-to-date, end quote. The prize provides readers with an overview of the modern energy industry and posits that peak oil, the premise that the world's oil supply is being rapidly depleted, is an outdated theory, and that with new discoveries in shale gas, we've instead reached a comfortable plateau when it comes to ferreting out fossil fuels from the ground. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Richard Heinberg, an author, a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, and a leading environmentalist, fundamentally disagrees with many of Dr. Yergin's ideas. And while both the prize and the quest are certainly recommended reading for Sea Change Radio listeners, Mr. Heinberg and I discuss why Dr. Yergin's view of reality differs so greatly from his own. I'm joined on Sea Change Radio by Richard Heinberg. He's an author whose latest book is The End of Growth, as well as a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. Richard, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be with you, Alex.
So have you read at least some of Daniel Yergin's much ballyhooed, very lengthy book on energy called The Quest, his follow-up to the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Prize?
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with the book. I can't say that I've read the whole thing.
Well, I can't really fault you for it. It's pretty long.
Yeah, I certainly know Daniel Yergin's work and you know, follow his work pretty closely.
Well, I mean, he has a lot to teach us in that he takes on energy as an enormous topic, and he's an educator in some ways. But as I tried to plow my way through this book, found myself scratching my head, and I really wanted to pick your brain a little bit about it.
Sure.
One of the things is he really looks at natural gas and shale gas as this is a terrific thing, that we really have some new opportunities because of the findings, particularly in North America, and shale gas could be everywhere. What kind of red flags go off in your head when you hear something like that?
You know, I think we ought to make it clear from the outset, Daniel Yergin is a spokesman for the oil industry. That's really his function. And I think it tends to color his analysis. So if you read the history of the oil industry in the prize, for example, it's you know, there's lots of useful information there, lots of good facts, but it is the history of the oil industry as the oil industry would like us to read it.
Could you expand a little bit on Mr. Yergin being a spokesman for the oil and gas industry? Is that related to his firm IHS, Cambridge Energy Research Associates?
Yeah, absolutely.
What is that all about?
Yeah, well, it's an oil industry think tank, basically. IHS used to be an independent company that did data collection for the oil industry, and they published yearly statistics for field by field production rates, decline rates, and so on. And it was pretty expensive to access that data. So IHS was then purchased by Cambridge Energy Research, and Daniel Yergin was hired on and elevated to the head of the whole operation.
Let me read to you a little bit from The Quest. He writes, Shale gas also began to have an impact on the debate on both climate change and energy security policy. By the beginning of this decade, the rapidity and sheer scale of the shale breakthrough and its effect on markets qualified it as the most significant innovation in energy so far since the start of the 21st century. Recent innovations have given us the opportunity to tap larger reserves, perhaps a century's worth, in the shale under our feet, President Obama said in 2011. The potential here is enormous. What's the problem with saying that this is such an innovative, revolutionary finding, and that we're all going to be okay now, and we don't have to cut back on any of our habits because we got shale gas now?
Okay. Well, first of all, it's true that energy analysts like myself, who tend to be more pessimistic about future supply, we failed to see the shale gas bubble coming. We were forecasting declining production of natural gas in the U.S. and higher prices. And in fact, that's what we were seeing until just the last few years. Now, the higher prices, and we're talking about prices going up to $12, $14 a thousand cubic feet. Historically, natural gas was down around $2 a thousand cubic feet. Okay, so prices were skyrocketing in the mid-aughts, and that created the incentive to apply and refine technology that had been around since the 1980s, namely horizontal drilling and hydrofracturing, and apply it to low-grade reservoirs, these shale reservoirs that are have very low permeability. So using explosives, millions of gallons of water, proppants, it's possible to fracture these shale reservoirs, liberate the gas very rapidly. And what we've seen, yes, is a very high rate of production of natural gas, and that's driven down the price. Okay, so what's going on under the hood? First of all, these wells have very high decline rates. So if you drill the well in January, by December, the rate of production from that well has plummeted maybe 60%, in some cases more than that. So that means, in order for it to work, in order to keep producing as much shale gas as we're doing now, we have to continually drill more and more wells. And we're talking about tens of thousands of wells. So after a while, you run out of places to drill. And that's actually happening already in some of the initial plays like the Haynesville and Barnett shale plays. Marcellus is one of the few that's still growing. Actually, production of gas from shale has pretty much flatlined in the last year.
Can you explain what Marcellus is and where it is first? Sorry.
Okay, Marcellus is a large play that in the northeastern part of the United States, where most of the drilling is going on right now is in Pennsylvania.
And this is where oil was first discovered in the 1860s.
Right, right, right.
So we know that there is some oil back there, but most of it was tapped by John Rockefeller and company in the 19th century. The easy oil.
If you look at the shale gas plays, a map of them across the U.S., it looks as though there's an enormous amount of stuff. It looks like practically drill anywhere and we're going to get shale gas. The reality is very different. Within these very large plays like the Marcellus, there are sweet spots, spots where you can actually produce the stuff at a profit. And what's happened is, of course, the companies that are going after shale gas are drilling the sweet spots first, leaving the crappier areas for later. And so it's the low-hanging fruit phenomenon. The first few years of shale gas production, we get increasing quantities being brought to market, and that brings down the price. But the problem is the price of natural gas in the U.S. has plummeted to the point where virtually everyone who's producing this stuff is losing money. So as they move away from the sweet spots, as they necessarily have to do, as they drill out those small core areas, production costs increase. And the situation for the industry right now is they're losing money with almost every cubic foot of natural gas that they produce. The only reason they continue to drill, and drilling rates have declined substantially in the last year, the only reason they are continuing to drill is because they are in hock to Wall Street. This is another story that isn't being reported. This is all another Wall Street bubble. Wall Street loans these smaller companies the money with which to drill. The companies buy up leases, and then they have to drill in order to maintain the leases, and they have to produce gas in order to satisfy Wall Street. But meanwhile, they're actually losing money on all the gas they produce.
And you chronicle this pretty effectively on your website. You cite articles with titles like Gas Boom Goes Bust and There Will Be Fuel After the Boom in Natural Gas, and by Eric Lipton and Clifford Krause's piece in New York Times. These are kind of the counterbalance to the Daniel Yergins of the world.
Right. Yeah. We have done our own analysis at Post Carbon Institute. And if folks want to go to our website, postcarbon.org, and look among our reports there, you'll find a report on natural gas that we did a year ago. We're currently updating that and extending the analysis to tight oil from shale deposits in places like North Dakota. It's the most extensive, thorough report on unconventional oil and gas in North America that has been produced to date. We've bought rights to all the proprietary databases so that we have well by well and field by field data for production, decline rates, investment costs, and so on. And the preliminary conclusion is we're going to see a decline in North American natural gas production, especially U.S. natural gas production, starting in probably about 2 years. And U.S. tight oil production, the unconventional oil from North Dakota and Texas that we've been seeing so much hype about, that will peak and start to decline probably within about 5 years also. So, you know, we're being told that we have 100 years of cheap natural gas. It's not going to be 100 years, and it's not going to be cheap. We're being told that the U.S. is the new Saudi Arabia, will be producing more oil than Saudi Arabia by 2020 or 2025. That's simply not true. And the reality is that the U.S. is going to continue to be dependent on imported oil. We will never be a natural gas exporter of any significance. And in fact, we're still importing on a net basis natural gas today. So unfortunately, the American people are being fed highly, highly misleading information on the energy front. And Daniel Yergin is right at the forefront of this public relations machine that is misleading the American public.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking with author Richard Heinberg. Let me get back to Mr. Yergin here. More than traffic, the environmental debate is centered on water. Critics warn that fracking may damage drinking water aquifers. The industry argues that this is highly unlikely, as the fracking takes place a mile or more below drinking water aquifers and is separated from them by thick layers of impermeable rock. Moreover, the industry has a great deal of experience with fracking. More than 1 million wells have been fracked in the United States since the first frack job 6 decades ago. Fracking uses small amounts of chemicals. The general trend now is to disclose those chemicals. There are so many holes to poke in that. Why don't you just begin?
Yeah, don't worry, folks. We know what we're doing.
I mean, the reason that this is important is Mr. Yergin is not necessarily somebody who's being put only on Meet the Press. He's also able to penetrate into the more liberal media as somebody who's a fair and balanced arbiter of energy, since he is well-respected in many circles. I saw him on Jon Stewart and The Daily Show. This is not somebody who's like who's thought of as the president of the Heritage Foundation or something.
yes, he's right. A million frack jobs have been done. And what we're talking about is doing another million. And okay, so in the ideal case, fracturing occurs far underground, under the aquifer. There's a small likelihood of leakage of methane and chemicals into the aquifer. Well, what happens if something goes wrong? And in fact, things do go wrong on quite a frequent basis. Bad well casings. What percentage of well casings end up, you know, being problematic? Well, even if it's 1%, and that's actually pretty optimistic, well, 1 out of 100, if you're talking about tens of thousands of well casings, that means thousands and tens of thousands of people will suddenly find their drinking water is polluted. Aquifers become polluted as a result of this. All it takes is one bad well casing, and it could lead to pollution on a pretty wide scale locally.
And what about the chemical disclosure thing that he mentions there? He says the general trend is now to disclose those chemicals. That, from what I've learned about fracking, that's just not the case. They have patents and 500 or 600 different chemicals that can go into this fracking process. And if anybody's seen Josh Fox's Gasland, there's a huge mystery on what these potions that are being injected into the ground are. Isn't that the reality? Or who are you to believe here?
That is the reality, and in court cases still to this day, when the industry has to answer for bad well casings or failed containment ponds or things of this nature, they still say that the chemicals used as proppants in fracking are proprietary and cannot be disclosed.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author Richard Heinberg. His most recent book is The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Richard, he also talks about capturing carbon, what's known as CCS, carbon capture and sequestration. In Dr. Juergen's estimation, CCS, or carbon capture and sequestration, has tremendous potential. How do people, you and your colleagues at the Carbon Institute, view this? Post-Carbon Institute view this?
It's going to be very expensive, both in investment terms and also in energy terms, to capture the CO2 from coal plants and to pipe it, to compress it, and to bury it underground. So this, it is being done on a very tiny scale, the pilot stage scale. And it's technically possible. We're not talking about some kind of new technology that has to be developed from scratch, like nuclear fusion or something like that. It's all, you know, basic stuff, compressors, pipelines, that kind of stuff. But it adds up. If we're looking at capturing and storing anywhere near the total amount of CO2 produced by coal combustion in the U.S., then we're talking about thousands and thousands of miles of pipelines, thousands of compressors, and finding places to bury all this stuff. It would be essentially on the same order of engineering as completely reproducing the entire oil and gas industry as it exists in North America today. So we're looking at trillions of dollars of investment for technology that will not actually produce energy, but that will actually reduce the amount of useful energy we're getting from coal, because it will take energy
and sequester it.
Yes. So our analysis says basically this is not going to happen. You know, despite all of the rosy projections of the coal industry, which, you know, has commercials and billboards all over the place talking about clean coal, the fact is coal is not clean. It never will be clean. And the idea of capturing and burying, you know, billions and billions of tons of CO2 on an annual basis is really just a public relations job. It has nothing to do with reality.
Behind a rainy To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author Richard Heinberg. We're discussing Daniel Yergin's The Quest. Dr. Yergin cites an MIT study, The Future of Coal, and he quotes, CCS, carbon capture and sequestration, is the critical future technology option for reducing CO2 emissions while keeping coal's use above today's level. Now, when I read that, I thought, well, he's throwing a little bone there to environmentalists saying, well, see, we're worried about emissions. But the oil and gas industry wants to say that these renewables are pie-in-the-sky fixes, and they're the pragmatists, and yet clean coal keeps getting perpetuated as one of these answers. And that's just about as pie in the sky as it gets.
Right. So think about this. If we have to spend trillions of dollars to capture the CO2 from burning coal, and we're actually not producing any more energy from that, all we're doing is cleaning up from the energy production we're already doing, why not just take those trillions of dollars and invest them in solar and wind and energy storage and the kind of energy infrastructure that will carry us into the latter half of the 21st century and beyond? Investing hundreds of billions and trillions more in coal doesn't make sense just from the standpoint that coal is a non-renewable resource one way or another, whether it's because of climate change or because of energy scarcity. We will be transitioning away from coal over the course of this century. So why not plan for that now, and rather than investing doubling down on our investments in a non-renewable and depleting resource like coal, why not just take that money and invest it on our real energy future? We have to understand that what we're facing here is a concerted and well-funded public relations juggernaut. And whether it's CCS or whether it's shale gas or shale oil, these are illusions and disinformation that are being deliberately fed to the American people to keep us from making sound energy choices. I mean, it's pretty obvious that we're going to have to transition away from fossil fuels, and the sooner we do it, the better. But the industry wants to delay that transition as long as possible so they can make as much money as possible up front. And guess who loses? We all lose. The American people lose, and especially future generations.
One of the red flags that I noticed in looking through The Quest by Daniel Yergin was that there was one 10-page chapter called Closing the Conservation Gap. So he does address this, but this is an 800-something page book. He has 10 pages about conservation. I won't use Dr. Yergin's book as too much of a straw man, but let's talk about the reality of conservation and what kind of, this does not necessarily have to mean sacrifice in the World War II sense. This can mean a changing in our habits the way the rest of the developing world has already kind of embraced, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, Americans use energy at twice the rate of people in Northern Europe, for example. And people there are not freezing to death in the dark. You know, they're living lives that with which they're actually happier than Americans are with our own lifestyle. So,
yeah, last time you were on, I think we talked about the Global Happiness Index.
That's right. That's right. So we could reduce our energy consumption very substantially without impacting our lifestyles. Now, then we get to a point where we have to look at the lifestyle itself and say, hey, wait a minute, is our lifestyle even making us happy? You know, living in spread out cities where we have to get in a car and drive in traffic jams to get to a store or to where we work, is that really the best way of organizing our lives? Rail projects and public transportation projects are on the rise in the U.S., which is a good thing. You know, the U.S. reached its high water level mark in terms of public transportation in the late 1940s. And since the late 1940s, we've been seeing public transportation decline and decline and decline. Well, that's starting to turn around now, partly as a result of high gasoline prices. So there is some good news to report, and of course there are new models for how public transportation can be implemented, things like the personal rapid transit or PRT systems that are being discussed in various places. I was just in Telluride, Colorado a few months ago. The transportation from one location to another is by way of a system of gondolas in Telluride that's always operating, and they run on renewable energy. It's free. You just hop on in any one location, and it takes you where you want to go.
But what's important is not necessarily the mode, and we hear things from gondolas to, I know that the Japanese are about to implement a magnetic train, which can go, I think, over 300 miles an hour. It's just, you can get from Nagoya to Tokyo in 45 minutes on these things. So the modes are, and the technology is exploding. But the key is people traveling together, not honking at each other in traffic jams in their little isolated cars, their little aluminum boxes.
Right.
And if we can somehow come together through transportation and make conservation a flashpoint, I think that's something that gives a lot of people in the movement a lot of hope.
Yeah, and you know, in the meantime, I think we're going to have to use our existing autos and trucks, but in a much more efficient way.
What do you mean?
Well, like more car sharing and car pooling, so that we don't see, you know, hundreds and thousands of cars passing on the highway every hour with just a driver and otherwise an empty vehicle, you know, 4,000 pounds of metal just to transport, you know, a
150-pound human.
Exactly. Yeah. It's from an efficiency standpoint, that's insane. But if you just put one more person in the car, you've just doubled the passenger per mile efficiency.
Which is similar to what the airline industry is always talking about. It's like they have to have full planes, basically. And that's what the hub system is predicated on, is trying to keep their costs down by having fannies in the seats.
Right. With the with air travel, it's highly uncomfortable, you know, being on a sardine in a can. But the reality is transportation is going to get more expensive as time goes on. We're headed toward a future that is less mobile. We will be more staying in one place more. And so let's get used to it and make more of the places where we are. And rather than just having the mentality of, well, we'll be in one place for a while and consume everything there and trash it and then move on. That's kind of the pioneer mentality that America was founded on. But, you know, we've gotten to the other coast. The whole place is full now. So it's time to settle down and grow up.
Yeah, I can't help but think of the comic Louis C.K., who has this monologue about airline travel and people complaining about being packed in sardine cans or the Wi-Fi doesn't work on it. It's like, and then what did you do? You sat in a chair and were catapulted like a god through the air from one coast to the other, where the pioneers that you speak of, these people used to, you know, half of them wouldn't make it when they were trying to spend, you know, 6 months to get across the country. And so in 6 hours, right, you get from New York to San Francisco and you didn't get enough leg room. So perspective is important in this whole process.
That's right. That's right.
Richard Heinberg, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's a pleasure, Alex. Thanks so much. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Who, The Meters, and Shuggie Otis. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.